welcome to another Big Mouth, the pop culture talk show for people with too much time on their hands and too many records on their shelves. My name is Andrew Harrison, and we've got a special edition for you this week, our very first pod clash with representatives of the esteemed Music That Sounds Like a Fridge Freezer Falling Down the Lift Shaft website, launched in 2008 for the intelligent music fan. The Quietus covers everything from early fall to late fall, as well as Japanese black metal, paranormal folk music, and monochrome Scandinavian electronica. They fly the flag for proper, exciting, inquisitive music and big long reads, and we're delighted to have two Quietus folk with us. John Doran co-founded the site with his friend of Big Mouth, Luke Turner, back in the day. As well as editing the Quietus, he's the author of the acclaimed book Jolly Lad, certainly the sharpest, most plain-speaking and funniest memoir of life-threatening substance addiction, depression and mental illness that you will ever read. Hello, John. Welcome to Big Mouth.
Hello. How are you doing? How's it going? And that's Japanese war metal to you.
Japanese war metal. All right. Okay.
Well, a fine distinction that I'm sure you're glad I'm drawn.
Well, this is why we've got you in, basically. So, you know, I mean, of the taxonomy of black death, speed, etc. metal, I was not aware that war metal existed.
War metal, I would say, comes from an English band called Bolt Thrower, who are one of my favourites, mm-hmm. who came around the kind of grindcore period, so the mid to late 80s. And they sing about war, you know, and but they're an absolutely fantastic band. I think they had a sponsorship deal from Games Workshop. Specifically that game... the futuristic war game.
Is that Warhammer?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So, right, so basically all the orcs they can carry.
Yeah, but I mean, the proliferation of sub and sub-genres of metal is something that I've recently been dipping my toes into dungeon synth. And dungeon synth is kind of like, it's essentially like an outsider music. Like some of the key texts to dungeon synth essentially sound like... it's like the heavy metal version of Moondog or Daniel Johnson or something. So it's like a synthesizer playing really doomy music and a guy croaking over the top about a really unsuccessful attempt by some orcs to storm his castle. But if you go even deeper, it turns out...
If you're just not into like the commercial mainstream dungeon synth, not just like the easy access
so
stuff.
If you go via Reddit or one of these kind of really infernal message boards, you'll find that... dungeon synth splits off into four more subgenres, and I'm too afraid to go any deeper than
that. Did you read that Alexis Petridis piece on kind of the different subgenres?
I did, and that was an excellent piece, I have to say.
You didn't think, oh, he's just so last week, he's missed out on all these other subgenres?
No, not at all. I mean, I kind of know Alexis, and I know that he really doesn't like that kind of music at all. So I think, and to be honest, I wouldn't have taken the commission. I thought he was mad for taking it because you're on a hide into nothing. To the outsider, extreme metal can seem so bizarre and so utterly kind of hard to get a purchase on that you were faced with the choice of either kind of writing for a partisan crowd or either writing mockingly for a crowd who know nothing about it. And I thought Alexis did a really good job of kind of straddling those two factions.
Well, yeah, if you want to sort of, you know, deepen your understanding and just like get out of that sort of mainstream dungeon synth, I mean, I'm sure that John can provide guidance on, you know, via the Quietus.
The only thing missing was Coffin Worm, but other than
Coffin Worm.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that a person, a genre, an album, a label or a thing?
It's death metal.
All right, Coffin Worm. Make a note of that, readers. Also with us, also from the Quietus, we have Anna Wood, reviews editor, also a contributor to Mojo Magazine, Caught by the River, and other good things. Hello, Anna. How are you doing?
Hello. I'm very well indeed.
Jolly good.
You.
Welcome to Big Mouth. You welcome me.
I just want to mention that about 12 years ago, I tried to learn the bass, spent 6 months trying to learn the bass, gave up, and I learned the bit from Cannonball, but I also learned a Bolt Thrower song, which I'm now trying to remember the name of. It just sounded like Jules. It just went... But I can play that on the bass.
There is
so I'm in the right job.
Excellent. Well, I mean, do you sort of like have pauses, like a coffee break in the day to just like knock out some Bolt Thrower bass jams in the Quietus office?
I wish
office?
I did. Maybe it's time to start that little habit.
Anna did welcome me into the Quietus office yesterday, and I'm delighted to tell listeners that it looks exactly as you would hope it would look. It looks like a cross between J.G. Ballard's office and the set of With Nail and I. It's
we
great.
Tied it up.
it's just books and
but
stuff.
But presumably with less bottles of whiskey kind of sat around.
There's a few of them hidden out of my line of view.
Absolutely. Anna, my sort of description of Quietus music earlier on was slightly tongue-in-cheek, but what's the core of Quietus music to you?
To me, well, I think of it as having been founded on John and Luke's love for metal, David Bowie, Prince, House, Dirty Rave, Squelchy Rave, Suede.
That kind of
thing. And then we just kind of keep on digging in, going along. You follow your nose, your hips.
Like an old carpet, it's dirty and squelchy, but it has a lot of underlay beneath it.
That's not the analogy I would have gone for, but I'm enjoying it. Anything that involves squelchy, any squelchy analogy, I'm gonna be on board with.
I do like the fact that the Quieters will also do pop at all times, and you even let me do Chris Lowe from the Pet Shop Boys, which was really nice. I'm particularly fond of...
And we've just started a pop column. It's very good.
Who's doing your pop column?
A woman called Annika Fowler.
Fantastic. Because it's a proper intelligent take on things without being boring and kind of overly academic, and that's what I find really enjoyable about the site. I'm particularly fond of the franchises like Junk Shop Classical.
That's a great column, isn't it?
For the listeners who don't know, it's a writer goes and just buys cheap classical records for £1 or 50p and rediscovers the rich history, which is... Where did that come from?
So that's my mate Phil Hebblethwaite, and he is like one of my heroes in journalism, really. He founded, with his friend Mickey, the independent Inky, the Stool Pigeon, and they used to make, commission, partially write, partially design and photograph, take to the printers and deliver around the country themselves. And they essentially were like years ahead of the game, you know, years before the NME decided to go free, years before, you know, Shortlist or whatever. Yeah. So, I mean, really kind of like all of these magazines that exist now, like Crack and Loud and Quiet, kind of followed in Steel Pigeon's wake. And anyway, you know, I like when Luke and I started the Quiets, we really looked up to Phil, this kind of fiercely independent, extra, like a workaholic, you know what I mean? And, you know, somebody who's just incredibly interested in the history of journalism and what can be done, despite things, you know, arguably fraying around the edges, still seeing that there's a lot of kind of fighting to be done. So anyway, he now works for the BBC, and he was just... Once he closed down the Steel Pigeon after about 8 years, I think he had a bit of, you know, he just reached a time in his life where he wasn't going out listening to as much hip-hop and R&B and stuff like that. And he suddenly, out of nowhere, discovered a love for classical music. And, you know, so for him, it's one of those columns. They don't always work, you know, this idea of, I'm a beginner, but why don't you come on this journey with me? But Phil's such a great writer and a good researcher that I think it really does work.
It's nice to have classical music with a Porter's Head scratchy record effect because you bought it for a pound or 50p or 25p. Absolutely. Also, with us helping me hold up the big mouth end of the game, you just heard him then, it's the Martin Rev to my Alan Vega, or more likely the Mick Fleetwood to my Samantha Fox. It's our producer, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt, how are you doing?
From a height perspective, possibly.
Absolutely, yes. Would you be interested in embarking on discovering classical music via the medium of the 50p bin?
Well, you know what? I found myself driving down the A1 on Monday for like 2 hours, and I found myself listening to Radio 3, which I don't think I've ever done for a mainstream Radio 3 kind of daytime programme, and I was quite getting into it. They were playing lots of 13th century kind of English folk music, which was quite nice.
There is a bit where you do sort of find yourself going, well, at least it's not pop music, thank God.
Well, it's actually, it was at least it's not Woman's Hour.
And there we go. Well, before we get started, just a little reminder to subscribe to Big Mouth on Apple Podcasts if you get a second, and leave us a nice review and a star rating if you can, because it helps us get seen and it spreads the word and all that kind of stuff. Also, don't forget to check out our partner show, Remaniacs, the No Bullshit Brexit podcast. Every week, Big Mouth regular Dorian Linsky, plus special guests, give you the best take on the unfolding Brexpocalypse. Links are available at Remaniacs.com, and you should probably chase Romaniacs with an episode of Big Mouth to cheer yourself back up. Okay, later in the show, we're going to be looking at BBC4's documentary on the infamous Soviet spy Guy Burgess, enticingly titled Toffs, Queers and Traitors. As a friend said, it sounds like my Facebook friends list. And we'll also be listening to some of our Quietest Guests' favourite music. But first, the Facebook, or rather a book about the face. Paul Gorman's The Story of the Face, the magazine that changed culture, is out now from Thames and Hudson. It's a large format book that charts the history of the original Style magazine, from its beginnings as a side project for Smash Hits creator Nick Logan, through the neo-romantics via Acid House and Britpop, and then its struggles and final demise in the noughties. There are few more fondly remembered magazines than The Face, so much so that our old bosses who founded The Word magazine, now owners of Mixmag and Kerrang, have just bought the brand and intend to resurrect it. What's the book like, and does The Face deserve its reputation? We're going to talk about it after this emblematic track from the magazine's early days. This is Deep Breath, Spandau Ballet, and To Cut a Long Story Short.
Turning, white light, running from strangers.
rattle off that Spandau Ballet, but to cut a long story short, national anthem of the troubled peacocks of new romanticism. Let's face it, that is a good record, isn't it? Although Matt was just arguing that the ultimate Spandau Ballet banger is Chant Number One, which it is.
Yeah.
With the horns of Beggar and Cow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But this is prime. This is peak kilt, isn't it?
Yeah.
This
the is thought of foreign. Hoisting kilts aloft is kind of quite scary.
What do Spandau Ballet wear under their kilt?
Well-tailored silk boxers, I'd have thought.
Hand-painted. We're talking about Paul Gorman's The Story of the Face, the magazine that changed culture, and it does feel like not just another era, but also another reality, where one person can set up a magazine on his own, essentially in the kitchen, and not only create a successful business, but change the culture around him. The downside was that, but for its first 5 years or so, it was the most elitist magazine ever. John, were you a Face reader?
I was for a brief time. So when I moved down south in 1993... from Manchester, to I spent a couple of years in a holdings circle.
I thought you were going to say a holding cell there.
Well, there was some of that. But I spent a couple of years in the home counties in Hertfordshire and Essex working in factories before I made the final move to London. So between about 93 and 97, maybe. And I was working nights in a factory, and I'd go out kind of raving in London at the weekend. And I really then, like, the Face was my lifeline to that, and being able to tune into Kiss FM were the kind of two things that made me think there was something beyond the walls of working in a factory or whatever. Do you know, like, when you have a kid, there's this weird, you have all of these kind of Pavlovian, well, they're not Pavlovian triggers, they're kind of really... kind of Proustian triggers that happen to you, and they only work once. You may bite on a rusk and suddenly you're like, wow, this is incredible, all the stuff that's coming back to me. And then the second time you have a rusk, you think, no, this is just a really rubbish biscuit. Yeah. I had that kind of rusk effect through looking at this. It was really nice seeing all of these covers that I had at the time, but essentially when I was buying it, it did just have stuff like The Prodigy and Blur and Oasis on the cover. And there was some great journalism in it, no doubt, but I kind of get the impression, looking through this book, that I kind of missed I missed its heydays, really.
Well, the interesting thing to me is it's essentially a book of two halves, because literally 50% of the book is the 80s and Robert Elms and expensive hand-painted ties and billion-pound trousers. And the second half is the 90s, where everything becomes more democratic, less London, more acid house, more baggy pants. The Revenge of the Suburbs, I think it's called. And that, to me, that was kind of... But, you know, the first half was the time when I kind of resented the Face, because I'm not in London hanging around in Soho coffee bars and being with Spandau Ballet. And so naturally I hated all of those people for that reason. And the second half, this was my friends and my world, and I found it much more engaging. Anna, were you a Face reader?
Yes, and I straddled those two halves. Mm. So looking at this, to be honest, the book itself, I didn't particularly... read. All I'm interested in really is the fact that this is basically like having the old pile of Face magazines in your bedroom, but
it is a brilliant, clever kind of book. It's they've managed to do an anthology of the Face without actually doing an anthology.
Well, you
of
can
the face.
Still, if you just hold it the right distance from the glazed eyes, can just about read it.
Should come
but
with a,
this whole sort of era from
glass.
Like from Safe Sex to Acid House and the chaps in the middle, basically the Wee Generation, is. Like John said, there's kind of pictures in here that I remember I haven't seen since I was 15, 16, which is the age I was then. And they did have an effect on me. And it's basically, it's me being reminded of the era when I sort of found my pop cultural feet, I think, really.
Yeah.
Like this, there's a cover here, Sinead O'Connor, The Right to Party. So, I mean, it's Sinead O'Connor's bald head, shaved head, and the thing about the government versus acid house.
Yeah. And,
you've got, like, that's 1990. And then the Corinne Day cover. Excuse me, the Corinne Day cover with Kate Moss. Now, I remember, I viscerally, absolutely, in a biting on the rusk way, I remember seeing that cover for the first time.
But that famous one is the Native American headdress. And the fact that she's smiling and wrinkling her nose, it just seemed to be a sea change from pouting, moody, and miserable. Yeah.
It was like seeing a woman who is my age, having a nice time with a mate. I mean, even though at that point I didn't know who Corinne Day was, but you could see that it's a mate, they're on a beach, they're having a laugh.
Yeah,
I didn't know what cultural appropriation was then either, so I wasn't worried about the headdress. And it was just nice to see a young woman having a laugh on a beach, basically.
Yeah.
And that made, and the photography all through those... I mean, I didn't read it in the 80s. I think my sister probably did.
Yeah.
But the photography is amazing. And the photography with, like later on, Elaine Constantine, who I'd forgotten about, and a brilliant photographer. And the same thing, the kind of intimacy with the models. Hmm. And even the style of the photography, that kind of ring flash, slightly Polaroid-y photography that was kind of carried on by... Then of course they went with Terry Richardson and got it all a bit wrong.
But I did read it from the start. I remember buying the first issue, and I remember that talk about Proustian, that picture of Jerry Dammers on the stairs was cut off and stuck above my bed, and that, you know, when I was kind of like, when was it? So 84, so I was 16.
That was like, no, it was 1980, wasn't it?
80, was it? Well, in that case, I was kind of 12, but I distinctly remember buying all of these, and it wasn't elitist at the start. You know, it had the front, the strap lines on the front cover of the first edition were Dex's Madness.
Well,
you know, and then there was, and then there was kind of, you know, but there was, you know, the Human League, Susie, Adamant, Boy George.
That's kind of the prehistory of the face. That's the first dozen issues where a music magazine, and it was like that. I mean, I think Nick Logan describes it in here as trying to be the NME Sunday supplement.
But it worked, and that kind of drew me into Frankie, and you know, and the whole Buffalo thing, and I think there's a difference between it being elitist and it being aspirational, and for a kid who was kind of living outside Bristol, who had no hope ever or desire or whatever to go to kind of like these London clubs. It was really smart writing. It was really good photography. And it was like a fantastic design. And I kind of thought...
Do you think it was elitist?
I think the mid-80s, basically sort of round about 1984 to... There's like a five-year period from like 1984 to round about when Acid House kicks in, when it has gone really Soho, and it really is only about the right coffee bars and the right trousers.
But that's not true. I'm sorry, I disagree, because that was when they were talking about, that was when they were covering kind of like, you know, Bomb the Base and...
No, that was afterwards.
Soul to Soul, and, you know, but...
That's all the stuff that came after, kind of funk stuff
that was, but Rare Groove, and that was what kind of, when I was kind of going out in Bristol, that was what, you know, people were listening to, and people were going to those kind of, and that, so that Hard Times, which is on one level a really silly thing that the Face is rightly derided for, because Robert Elmer's the guy who wrote it, literally the one issue was in kind of ripped jeans and kind of leather jackets and quiffs and looking all kind of moody, and literally the week before or the month before had been hanging out down with Blue Rondo a la Turk in a zoot suit and a kind of hand-painted 300 quid silk tie. But actually, you know,
that sounds great. Both of those things sound great.
And that they were both great of their time, and that hard time thing was.
I think this elitism thing might actually be to do with the fact, part of why it was a great magazine, because it was a group of mates doing a magazine about stuff they were interested in.
I mean, they literally do say we were elitists and we were proud to be elitists.
But so
it depends. I don't feel like they were elitist. They were just doing stuff they loved. And there's a real, maybe it's because I was reading it a bit later. Like the period just after the one you're describing. But you can tell that they love the readers. And that little bit, like slightly later still, when there's the whole Jason Donovan debacle, and they're sued by Jason Donovan and they lose and they're in huge debt and they have to ask the readers for money. And the tone they use, there's the kind of editor's letter from Nick Logan, and then there's introduction to that issue by Cheryl Garrett, who's a great writer. I've forgotten how much I loved her, actually, you know, writing. And the way they talk about the court case and their readers and the Face is so kind of, it's done with a light touch, but it's so righteous and loving. And they love the readers. They're asking for help and they're telling the readers how much they need them and love them, and without being as cheesy as that sounds. And that's the opposite of elitist.
Well, yeah. I would say they had a very, very elitist four-year period at the height in the 80s, where it was very much about we're in and you're not. But the Face that I loved was after that, when it was what you've just described, which was we're opening it out and we're looking at the rest of the country, and actually it's people flooding into London and changing the culture. The caricature of the Face that, you know, often for people who didn't read it, was that it was just a load of style fops showing off. But actually what's very clear from this book is that the journalism was fantastic. There's pages in there that I can, you know, the intro or the first sort of, or the pull quote, the first few lines, I can clearly remember reading that story in its entirety and it making a huge impact on me. You know, that was the secret weapon. It was as well written as Vogue or as well written as the Sunday Times magazine.
Yeah. And the photography was great. I mean, I'm surprised by how many, and the fonts. I didn't realise I cared about fonts when I was 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, but obviously I did, because there's typefaces in there that I'm like, oh, I remember that. Oh, lovely kerning, you know.
Yeah. The book does sort of, you know, possibly out of kindness, doesn't go too deeply into the magazine's decline and end.
So in 1987, when I moved to London, I kind of stopped buying the Face almost overnight. And it was weird, like I got a job as a journalist, my first ever one, on a news agency based on the Old Street Roundabout. And so, like, 1997 was such a really kind of amazing, in a way, time to move to Shoreditch to become a writer or whatever. Yeah. And I think there's, like, this symbolic thing was obviously happening everywhere, whereas, like, in my local pub, the Griffin, you could get copies of this free sheet thing called the Shoreditch Twat or whatever. Yeah. But also in the office above us in Zetland or Zealand House, I think it was called, like some young books had just started up a magazine called Sleaze Nation. And
Sugar Ape.
Yes. Now, the thing is that this is my problem with the TV series Nathan Barley, was it didn't go far enough. It wasn't grotesque enough. I clearly remember going up to have a look around, and there was this bunch of clowns stood around a £1,000 inflatable desk, which would just sink to the floor every time they put the receptionist's phone on it.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, for better or for worse, despite this kind of idiocy, you could tell that immediately all of this stuff was making the face just utterly redundant. Like, you know, there was just a huge change. Like,
yeah, I mean, face found it very hard to survive in this world where, like, everything is a huge ironic joke and it's all about, you know, how much of an extreme moron can you be? But none of that stuff has lasted. I mean, can you see a compilation of magazines like Sleaze Nation being of any interest?
No, absolutely
right now?
Not. And there's absolutely no way I'm going to argue devil's advocate for Sleaze Nation or any of those magazines. I'm not interested in doing that. But what I am saying is that there was another cultural shift, and that's why.
Isn't there
why the face went to the wall.
Isn't there an argument for those kind of magazines being kind of, you know, the great magazines sum up and capture the mood of a generation, or maybe kind of two generations at most?
Two in the face's case.
And then after that, you know, they wither and die naturally.
They have shelf lives, yeah.
Well, I think this is a fantastic book, and it's hugely of interest to, if you've got any interest in pop culture, but also in media. I really enjoyed it, despite the fact that, like, I'm in it towards the end in a page that makes me want to curl up and die as I launch a magazine for Nick Logan and lose him tens and possibly hundreds of thousands of pounds with a terrible bad idea that should never have been done. If he's listening, I apologise for that.
So you're basically nipping down to the nearest Waterstones and got with the razor blade.
I'm just going to razor that page out in shame. Yeah. So The Story of the Face by Paul Gorman is available now in bookshops, I believe. Okay, let's move on to some present-day pop music. We always ask the guests to bring in something that they'd love to play to you, the listener, their own personal editor's recommendation, if you like. Anna Wood, what have you got for us?
Princess Nokia. I think we're playing Tomboy.
Tomboy. Tell us about Princess Nokia.
This is the first song I heard by him, actually, a little while ago. And then I saw her live last Friday in Brixton, and it was just really exciting. Mm. And just that feeling occasionally you get when you go to a gig, when you stand there thinking, this is just better than everything else. Mm-hmm. Not in a mean-spirited way, just in a delighted, exciting way. And it was the Electric, which is a great venue anyway. Good size. You can see the stage from everywhere. And she came, well, in fact, before she came on, it felt good because the crowd was really, like, mixed, friendly crowd. That sounds so anodyne, but, like, just everyone was, it felt a bit like being at a rave, actually. Now, her album's called 1992, and it felt a bit to me like being in 1992. At one point, I got a bit freaked out. I looked around and was like, I can't tell what, I could be in 99. There was one person with a mobile phone. That's how I knew I wasn't. Like, there
and it was a really big brick.
There was a girl. Like, it would have been a pager, wouldn't it, in 92? But there was a girl with, like, those little Bjorky pigtails on her head, wearing dungarees. And there was people in, like, crop tops and baggy jeans and Adidas and big gold hoops. It all looked like that. And everyone was just chatting and friendly. And everyone was not, it wasn't just one demographic. So many gigs I go to, and this is my own fault, are just one demographic. And everyone was just a bit friendly and excited. And then she comes on, and it's like, whoosh, to the back of the room. This energy goes through, and she starts with this song. And it was just so exciting.
Who is she and where is she from?
She's a New York hip-hop woman, yeah.
Well, let's have a listen. This is Princess Nokia and Tomboy.
Baby fat, I be where the ladies at. Who know how to shake it fast? We gon' spit that brazy trap. You know that I'll take it back. I'm spitting the illest man. Yeah, ho. Who that? Who that? Who that? Princess Nokia, make it clap. She with it to set it back and give you the fire track. Y'all watch what gon' happen next.
Princess Nokia with Tomboy, as chosen by our guest Anna Wood of The Quietus. Now, as with coffee and other stimulants, the more music you listen to, the more you need something unusual to get the same effect. And it's hard to get the thrill of discovering something really new. hence the existence of the Quietus, and records like the next one that we're going to talk about. Habibi Funk, an eclectic selection of music from the Arab world, pretty much does what it says on the tin. It brings together Zouk, Lebanese AOR, Arab disco, and all manners of mutations from North Africa. What's it like, and will you enjoy it? We're going to talk about it after this track. This is the opening track by Fadul, and I hope I'm going to pronounce this correctly. This is Bishlama Habibti. Fadul and Bishlama Habibti from the album Habibi Funk, an eclectic selection of music from the Arab world. John Doran was grooving away like a good un there. You're a big fan of this kind of thing, aren't you? What's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a no-brainer. If I don't have parties, I don't throw them. I'm too old, too misanthropic. You know,
get out of my house.
Yeah, exactly. But if I did throw parties, this is exactly the sort of record I'd put on. I can recommend this compilation wholeheartedly. Now, I would say that, you know, it's quite an easy entry point into kind of any kind of Levantine music from the 60s and 70s, because essentially what you're talking about is an East-West fusion. And this music, it's kind of great. It does this weird cultural Doppler effect. It simultaneously sounds really, really familiar. So you'll notice that on this compilation, I think there's a James Brown cover, and there's also a version of Harlem Shuffle.
Called Casablanca Shuffle.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, straight away, you're like, this is almost like kind of wedding disco music. And ironically, this is where a lot of these people would have earned the money back in the day. But at the same time, there's also something, I don't want to use a word that others this music too much, but there's something quite alien sounding about it as well. So I find it really thrilling. I have to say that if I'm out DJing, the music I tend to go for is probably something a little bit more modern, a little bit more raw, and a little bit more off the beaten track. So like Dabka from Syria or Chabi from Egypt. And to draw an analogy, this compilation, It's like mod music, essentially, whereas the stuff that I kind of DJ when I'm playing out is more like the equivalent of grime or dancehall. But yeah, I think this, I'll tell you something that's been boiling my goat about this sort of music, which I will get off my chest really quickly right now.
Is that straight out of the Profanosaurus? Boiling my goat?
I coined that myself last week.
now dropping it into every conversation in the hope that it becomes lingua franca.
So there's a website called Rogue Chiefs, and the academic Abigail Gardner, who I should mention is white and middle class because it's very pertinent to this, wrote an article recently called Whose Record Is It Anyway? Digging Up and Reissuing Old African Music is New Colonialism. So, like, her point in this article was to say that back in the day, she was a big fan of Fela Kuti and the Bundu Boys, and she had no problem with those records. But today, she finds there to be a colonial attitude in kind of white collectors going over to Africa, buying up this music and reissuing it. And actually, the idea that EMI Nigeria was some sort of workers' co-op in the 70s, and these tiny, tiny little labels who sell barely any copies, like Habibi Funk, are somehow
all roads of pop.
Yeah, exactly. It's so wrong-headed, it's almost Orwellian. Like, now, if I was say, for example, that song we played never got released commercially back in the day. It was a demo. Mm. So when these albums come out now, sometimes these musicians are getting paid for the first time ever for producing that particular song. I know definitely Yanis, who runs this label, pays 50% of all the money to the artist, straight to them, not to the record label, straight to them or their family if they died in the intervening years. And that's before taking out any kind of expenses or whatever. And I just think, like, really, I really have so much respect for a lot of these labels and what they're doing.
Anna, what did you make of this? Sorry, I feel like I've left you out on this one. Tell us how you felt about this.
That's
one.
That's all right.
Boil your goat?
One of the things I loved about this album, as well as the fact that the music is pretty great, is the booklet that comes with it, written by Yanis, which is just a thing of... It's just a delightful piece of writing. He's got an introduction where he talks about that specifically. He talks about taking the kind of... looking at the post-colonial landscape and being extremely aware of... not willing to reproduce those kind of exploitative business models. Yeah. He's completely transparent about the 50-50 thing and about contacting people and contacting the artists, I mean, and making sure they're paid properly. And then after the introduction, each song has a few hundred words about
an essay
it.
Yeah.
So it's so, I mean, it's just, it's a delightful thing, the booklet. Set. But before I read the booklet, I listened to the album and... I quite like having it both ways, you know. I like listening to it and feeling a bit like I don't know where I am with this, and that kind of slightly white English woman thing of going, oh well, this, I recognise this bit, and you know, listening to the Casablanca shuffle and thinking, oh, and you know, they have you have that moment of going, oh god, it's House of Pain, or you know,
steady,
and then he kind of, you know, and it's actually
wrong with House of Pain.
There's quite a lot wrong with House of Pain, and then it's better than the Rolling... I mean, I don't know if the Rolling Stones wrote it or not, but it's certainly better than their version. And the singing is, you know, it's a wonderful kind of, almost like a Vic Reeves club singer kind of singing over it. It's that opening track that we just played is just a delight. And the next track, Wang Dang, I think it's called.
Wang Dang by Bob Destiny.
Bob Destiny.
How can you not love Bob Destiny?
And that one is... I mean, so that guy, he was from New Orleans originally, and he moved over to Algeria... I think, and then Morocco, and then ended up in Europe. Is that right?
Yeah.
I know all this from the notes, not like I'm an expert. But you can kind of hear that, you know, just the name Wang Dang, you have a feeling it might have something to do in New Orleans, and it's kind of brassy and fizzy and a bit filthy, and it's wonderful music.
Really, once you start looking into the actual history of these songs, you start seeing not just... a one-way street where there's kind of rich Europeans taking something from there, but actually a very rich interplay of kind of influences from Africa to New Orleans, New Orleans to Tunisia to Germany, and so on and so forth, you know.
I just felt it was quite interesting that there wasn't, you know, the only kind of Moroccan stuff that I'd listened to before was the kind of master musicians of Djouka and that kind of drone, like, trance stuff from the Maghreb and whatever. And I thought it was quite interesting because you're just getting a completely different picture of, you've almost got the kind of cliched image of these kind of white-robed Sufis kind of hanging out up in the mountains, getting off their kind of tits on kif or whatever, and then down on the coast playing in the hotels, these kind of funky brothers kind of like.
Sure, and I think this stuff is really, really important. There's like a really deep political angle for me listening to this stuff. It comes secondary to the pleasure of listening to it. But when you take a country like, for example, Mali, you know, to talk about a Mali sound is as idiotic as talking about a specific Jamaican sound or a specific English sound. There is none. It's a very complex country that you can split roughly into four parts, and each with their own kind of traditions. And like that's going from heavy electronic music all the way to desert blues
Delta
rock.
Blue.
And, you know, it's the same in Morocco. You know, Morocco is a deeply complex society. And the more we know about the music, I feel that the more you understand the culture and so on and so
forth. Well, that was how I got a handle on this, was just thinking about that kind of Tuareg kind of desert blues. And actually, there's more of a similarity with what's on this record and that and the stuff that those groups are coming out with now. And you can think that kind of moving around that kind of area without worrying about what particular country people are from and whatever.
Okay, so that's Habibi Funk, an eclectic selection of music from the Arab world, which I think it's fair to say unanimous approval there. Go out and buy it. Let's move on from the grandeur of the Arab world to a man who liked to squander his time and moral fibre in the alleyways of Tangiers. Charming, clever and Eton-educated, Guy Burgess was the most flamboyant and dissolute of the Cambridge spies. After a decade as a Soviet mole within the BBC and MI6, Burgess defected to Russia in 1951 along with Donald MacLean, and the ensuing scandal laid bare the class complacency that had enabled a well-connected good chap to betray his country without anyone being so vulgar as to suspect him. A new film by George Carey argues that Burgess and many of the Cambridge spies' homosexuality wasn't simply a point of weakness that opened them to blackmail. Instead, it was central to an outsider identity that enabled them to work against a society that they saw as irredeemably hypocritical. Toffs, Queers and Traitors from BBC Four is still on the iPlayer. Here's a taste of it. This is the remarkable pre-war moment when infamous traitor Guy Burgess gives sound advice to a down and depressed Winston Churchill.
The visit to Chartwell became Burgess's favourite after-dinner story. A recording of him telling it was eventually located in the FBI archive in America. Burgess says that when he arrived, he started straight out on the political crisis surrounding appeasement.
Personally, I said, I am in some despair. And Mr. Churchill said, my best answer will be to show you a letter.
The letter came from Mr. Benesch of Czechoslovakia, pleading for help against the Nazis.
Here am I, said Mr. Churchill, an old man, without power and without party. What help shall I give? And I thought, said the right thing at that moment and said, oh, Mr. Churchill, don't be so downhearted. Offer him your eloquence.
This is Burgess's kind of finest hour, that, you know, the man who saved Britain turned to Burgess at his hour of need, and Burgess gave him the answer.
The voice of Cambridge spy Guy Burgess, including his famous Winston Churchill impersonation from BBC Four's Toffs, Queers and Traitors, still on the iPlayer. Anna Wood, what did you make of this documentary?
I just really enjoyed all the lovely posh names and posh accents and, like, people being interviewed in front of bookcases and with just glimpses of leafy outdoors and this kind of quite fast-moving, really, slightly incestuous gossip that just flies through it, you know.
How bunty.
And then there's this kind of oblique history lessons as well. My favourite kind of history lessons, really, where you kind of know the outlines of it and you just get lovely little details. And so many brilliant lines.
Who's jazzed up to the eyeballs is my favourite.
jazzed up to the eyeballs.
Exactly. Yeah. And things like, or some guy going, this is a photograph of my father meeting Franco. Yeah. Just lined that. You know, it was just packed with these things. And Burgess described as having shabby glamour and an unrestrained appetite for sex with other men.
Yes.
And it's just and I thought it was kind of edgy even to have queers in the title, but no one ever says queers, they say queers.
It's class. Queers. Yes. Yeah.
So I enjoyed all of this. I enjoyed all the gossip. I enjoyed the kind of stories of villas in Tangier. I didn't get enough of a sense, really, of Guy Burgess. And it reminded me, I guess maybe because I've been looking at the Facebook, it started to make me think of my kind of pop cultural youth, I suppose, and it reminded me and made me want to watch again Another Country, which is the Rupert Everett film from, I don't know, when I was mid-late
80s. 86, isn't it?
Yeah. And where Rupert Everett plays Guy Burgess. Mm. And I remember watching that as a kid, and that's why I know who he is, really. Or that's why I first knew who he is. And I had a real sense of him and a little bit of what you're talking about with how his homosexuality was a kind of potentially part of why he became a traitor.
Well, it seems to be, I mean, this is where what we now think of as the cliche of the Cambridge spy ring and the cliche of Le Carré actually was created, happened, you know, in real life. You had a clique of people in Cambridge where I think someone says partway through the documentary, all thinking people were pro-Stalin at this point because the opposition
all right-thinking
was Hitler.
People, yeah.
Yeah, all right-thinking people, which led them into very sort of dark places.
Although we find it glamorous. They didn't say pro-Stalin, they said pro-Soviet.
That was Stalin.
No, there's a distinction there.
No, well, yes. Let's
well, there is a distinction because Guy Burgess makes it later on. Yeah.
Well,
he makes a distinction very... Well, they thought there was a distinction. That's what's crucial.
They thought there was a distinction. And you know, this is where you see that the idea that being homosexual and being, you know, unsound and unpatriotic all becomes welded together into this one idea, this cliche of the you know, the dissolute, corrupt, you know, posho. And,
it sounds so good when you put it like that, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, my question is, you know, we look at this, it sounds terribly glamorous and it sounds very, very sophisticated and very kind of independent-minded, but actually they did send hundreds of people to their deaths. Should we be thinking of this as glamorous?
Who sent hundreds of people to their deaths?
Well, these spies.
This boiled my goat so hard, the pan was dry. I got 2 hours sleep last night because this documentary made me so angry. And I need to clarify that it's a brilliant film. I'd urge anyone to watch it. It's the clearest insight I've heard on a TV documentary to the role of homosexuality in it, which people kind of step gingerly around, don't they? You know, for fear of kind of saying something offensive. I thought the insights into homosexuality and espionage were quite, you know, quite well made here. It was happening at a time of rupture. There was a deterritorialization and a re-territorialization with the most awful consequence, you know, as in, like, I'd never thought of it before, but yeah, clearly a few months after everything gets wrapped up, Alan Turing gets thrown under the wheels of the bus, one of the greatest men this country has ever produced, you know. But for me, and I'm sorry to be chippy about this, but it's just brought out every class war fibre in my being. Because we're being told time and time again, Guy Burgess was a brilliant man. Where was the evidence for this? What were his secrets? He didn't have any secrets, did he?
He didn't have any good information.
He was all a bit desperate. Like,
he had nothing other than his old school contacts.
And he was, and he did really bad in his exams at university.
He was a buffoon. He was an absolute oaf. You know, this whole thing of, like, you know, if it wasn't for the class blinkers, you know, I watch news and I'll think, look at Boris Johnson. What is he doing? Now, I would say they're very similar characters in a lot of ways. And I would hesitate before saying, do you know what? I could do a better job than Boris Johnson.
My cat.
But I would not. I would not hesitate for a second before saying I would be a better spy than Guy Burgess. I would be. Anyone would be.
Although I thought that the most interesting thing that I kind of knew the broad brushstrokes of this story, but I thought the most interesting thing, which I didn't know about, was the report that was published that wasn't published after it all went off at the end of the McLean and Burgess went to Russia, where a report was written for the security services saying, well, given that the repression and the fact that that homosexuality was illegal, there is a reason for this group of people coming together and becoming quite dependent on each other.
Sure,
and I thought that was a kind of, and the fact that that was written, and as the guy who kind of talks about it in the documentary was saying, it was quite a kind of, for that time, quite a liberal discussion of homosexuality and the fact that it couldn't be cured and that it shouldn't be cured. But you can see why in the 20s, given the kind of febrile atmosphere and given the fact that these people were kind of at risk of being arrested and kind of thrown out of polite society every time they kind of met their friends or kind of got together, you can kind of understand why that dangerous kind of little clique came together and thought, why should we, you know, this is a better situation to support.
Also, you can turn around and say that this kind of dangerous clique came together and took what was a relatively liberal enclave for themselves and spoiled it beyond recognition.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, you can sort of understand the impulses that made them want to set themselves apart from society, but it led them to commit an enormous crime, which we, with hindsight, can see, you know, that they absolutely had backed the wrong horse in the biggest way going.
But actually,
two wrong horses, wasn't there, I think? I mean, there are similarities of what's going on now. And I did, there was the bit where they talk about Guy Burgess becoming the producer of This Week at Westminster or whatever on the BBC.
And that's a great bit,
then you think it's not unbelievable, because then you look at Trump and all the Putin palaver and you look at what's going on and you think, well, of course there's some kind of underskilled, overconfident posho.
Yeah,
so you just get this
completely,
like,
treacherous running things. I mean, that's how we're working now.
Confederacy of dunces, where everyone, everyone is an idiot. So, they're about to make their escape to France, but luckily they've got their best man on the job, Dick White, who is quoted as being MI5's top guy. He gets to the airport to find that his passport is out of date. And even somebody incredulously off camera says, "This isn't how it happens on the movies."
They do their flit at the weekend, but of course the office is closed, so we can't possibly do anything.
Everyone knows they're heading for the boat, and then, but on Sunday night, they go, like, "Oh, we've done our time," and the MI5 office is closed, and everyone goes home on Sunday evening.
Brilliant.
There are stories missing here, I think, as well. So one of my favourite bits was the night when they were going to get the ferry, and it was Don McLean, so I kept singing American Pie, Don McLean and Guy Burgess have dinner with Donald's wife, Melinda, who's pregnant, and then they go off and they eventually get to Moscow. It takes some years, doesn't it? But they eventually get to Moscow. Now, she gives birth 3 weeks later to her daughter. Her name's Melinda McLean. She calls her daughter Melinda, which is just a brilliant touch, I think. A few years later, she has an affair with Kim Philby, spends 3 years with him, then leaves him again, goes to Moscow to get back with McLean, and then ends up in New York, where she died a few years ago, having never said a word publicly to anyone about any of it. Now, this is the woman that I'd like to be mates with. Where's that?
She sounds like the real brain.
Where's the Hollywood story on that?
My favourite line in it was the human resources person at BBC, or whatever they called it in those days, saying that it was okay to recruit Burgess because he'd been through his bout of communist measles.
Yeah.
As if it was just passive.
It's a great phrase.
Yeah. You know, communist measles. Okay, that's enough about Dreadful Traitors. Let's have some more music, specifically some more stuff from the world of the Quietus. John Doran wanted to bring in a load of terrifying Indian black metal and 70s Black Sabbath stuff, but for the sake of your nerves, we've gone instead for one of Anna's suggestions, something by Zimpel Zolek. Anna Wood, who are they and what are they all about?
Well, this was a quieter suggestion, because okay. We all love this. It's two Polish experimental musicians, I guess. One of them's more jazzy, this is my understanding, one of them's more jazzy, one of them's more folky.
Yeah, so you've got Václav Zimpel, who's like he's essentially a pipes player. He plays a Laotian harmonica, he plays a clarinet, and then you've got Kuba Ziwek, who is a virtuoso 12-string guitar player. And they've come together. For my money, they're like two of the most interesting figures in the Polish underground, and they've come together finally to do this record, which it kind of... Essentially, it sounds like it's like a modern minimalist record, the pop end of minimalism. Anyone who's heard a bit of, like, you know, Philip Glass or Michael Nyman or whatever will kind of recognise this style of music. But if you listen to the deep production on it, it really puts me in mind of kind of minimal techno, to be honest.
Bloody Poles coming over here doing all our minimal techno for us. Here we go. This is Zimpel Zolek. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly again, with a bit of Memory Dome. Axes of gold burn to the ground. All you see, make memory of the hands written on the walls. Somehow, trails of course on the ground. I know you wake up right now. Zimpel Zolek with a bit of Memory Dome. The whole 13 minutes is available via Bandcamp, and jolly nice it is as well. John, you're an enormous fan of this, aren't you? I mean, do you guys feel like, with the world of the Quietus, do you feel like you're custodians of something? In that, I mean, you know, the Wire magazine covers it quite a lot, but there isn't really anything like your site in the world.
No, absolutely not. I can't. I mean, even if I did feel that I was a custodian of anything, I wouldn't admit it in public. But no, not really. I'm just like, you know, I think I'm lucky enough to be able to just do my job and nothing else, which gives me the luxury of time to do, like, maybe more digging than somebody who just does this at the weekends or in the evenings. And the further afield, it just makes sense to me. The way we've approached the Quietus from the beginning is, look, if literally everyone else online is writing about Drake and writing about The National and writing about Arcade Fire, then there's just no point in us doing it. I'm not saying we don't. We do occasionally. But what I'm really looking for is unoccupied territory where there's really, really good music. And the most obvious places to look are kind of like international countries where we don't already have like a huge kind of history of shared music. So as much as I love reggae and dub and stuff like that, you know, I'm not primarily concerned with looking to Jamaica. I would sooner think where more later waves of immigration into this country come from. And they've come from places like North Africa, West Africa, they've come from the Middle East, and they've come from places like Eastern Europe and Poland. So primarily, I try and look for music coming out of these places, and there's a number of different reasons, and one of them's kind of quite social, you know.
So I did ask Anna and John for some quick hot takes on Quietus tips, so let's do these quickly. Anna, Alice Coltrane ashram chanting gigs.
Alice Coltrane was part of an ashram, and some of them are over this weekend doing two gigs, I guess you could call them, at St Luke's LSO, just near Old Street, and I'm going to both of them because I'm greedy. So there's the morning one, free food and chanting.
Excellent.
And then in the evening, more chanting, more free food. And in between, I'm going to see Pharoah Sanders at the Barbican.
Busy day for you.
That's the most free jazz day possible, isn't it?
I mean, it's beyond free jazz. It's beyond free
you'll
jazz.
You'll come out, you'll be speaking
cosmic
scronk
cosmic
when
universe.
You come out.
I'll be, yeah.
Doran, you suggested Tetragrammicide's Primal Incinerator.
No. We're not going to talk about that. On Saturday night, I'm going to an illegal warehouse rave.
All right, where's that?
And the UKAEA, not the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority, but the techno act of the same name, and Dwellings, which is Chris from Nod and several other electronic producers.
Verdus. Okay, and you also suggested something else, which we're going to play now, which is Vilna by Vedoya. Vedoya. My pronunciation is right way off beam here. Sort of an offshoot of Magma, it says here. This is French prog, yes?
Yeah.
What makes French prog different from Anglo prog?
Oh, man. Listen, when you said better what you're listening to, I just said, oh, Andrew, I just listened to nothing but French prog at home because I was trying to think of the most quietest thing possible to say to you. I do listen to other things as well. No, this is a recommendation from my mate Carvis, who used to be in the Cardiacs and who DJs with Steve Davis, and I'm a guest on his radio show quite a lot. I've just been getting into the funkier side of prog.
All right.
Yeah, and it's a prog you can dance to. I'm all about that. And he said, check this album out. And it is absolutely astounding.
Can you say it and pronounce it properly? Because I'm not pronouncing it.
I think it's Vedoge. But...
Vedoge. Okay. Well, let's have a listen to all 12 minutes of Vilna by Vedoge. Quick 12 minutes, wasn't it? That was Vilna.
That went past so quickly. That's
what the funky side of prog will do to you. Radio edit time there, bringing us to the end of the show, which means closing time chatter, where our guests tell us what's been boiling their goat this week, what they're going to be talking about when last orders ring out in the local pop-up coffee shop near you. Anna Wood, tell us about the Anger Window.
Well, the Anger Window is open is a line from a piece I read in New York Magazine this week by Rebecca Traister. And she's talking, of course, about the sexual harassment allegations and the whole kind of wave of stuff that's been happening since the Weinstein allegations came to light. The more I read about this and think about it and talk to people and get emails from friends, and it just keeps on coming, and I'm finding it extraordinary and really exciting and kind of confusing and heartbreaking. There's just a lot going on, a lot to process, a lot to get your head around, and maybe more for men than for women, because on the whole, not wanting to generalise too much, and hashtag not all men, women have been having to think about this for longer and more carefully and in more detail generally than men have. It reminded me of a joke from the David Foster Wallace graduation speech that he gave a few years ago, which you may know. There's two young fish swimming along and an old fish is coming the other way. And as they pass each other, and the older fish says, "Morning, boys. The water's cold today, eh?" And they carry on swimming. And then after a while, one of the younger fish says to the other fish, "What's water?" I feel a bit like that, except that there's lots of blokes going, "What's patriarchy?" And it's like, and women are doing it too. Everyone's just going around going, "Oh, okay, it's everywhere. And everything's been wonked by it for such a long time." And I'm not saying this is like the great new dawn, everything's going to suddenly change, but it is exciting. And you can't close an anger window, basically.
Well, I read a line the other day, which was 2016 was the year that all your heroes died, and 2017 is the year that the remaining ones become dead to you because of the things
well,
that
they weren't my heroes, mate. Yeah, that's the thing.
Okay, John Doran.
I've got to say that I got up at 5 o'clock this morning, Mike. Goat already being thoroughly boiled by Guy Burgess and his buffoonery.
Have you got this on a T-shirt?
I'm going straight to the printers after this show. And I read the Anger Window feature, and now I must admit that's boiling my goat more than any other kind of trivial stuff I might have been angry about before reading
it. Well, you don't have to be angry about it. This is closing time chatter, isn't it? Necessarily. Tell us about your new Weird Britain thing.
Okay, so, what I've been noticing over the last 18 months, and this is no way a spurious attempt to me to kickstart a genre of music, is that like...
What, dungeon synth is over? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, completely over. So new Weird Britain is essentially, it's a way for me to label the absolute plethora of like underground DIY gigs that are happening in the UK at the moment, which are happening way, way outside the kind of lens of most of the media. They're happening in DIY spaces, warehouses, kind of like independent festivals, and the music, it's not a genre in that there's any kind of music linking them, although it tends to be non-standard music, stuff that's quite easy to do, quite kind of quite DIY, but mainly electronic, mainly shows put on by women and featuring women. But really, it's a multimedia thing. So you tend to get people using film, using sometimes dance costumes. And it's inversely proportional to people's class and how much money they've got. You know, it sounds kind of quite pretentious, but really, from what I'm seeing, it tends to be people with no money who come from more of a working class, lower middle class background, just thinking, I'm never going to earn any money as a musician. So what's the point in me trying to be the Sherlocks or, you know, some landfill indie band or whatever? Why don't I just save up for a fortnight and put on this super weird party for all of my mates in an abandoned warehouse where we play kind of Gabba and we all dress up as kind of, you know, as in the Lone Taxidermist case where all of our mates are dressed up as anatomically correct vaginas that squirt custard over the audience.
Sounds like a great night out. New Weird Britain coming to a tabloid front page near you shortly. Matt Hall, what have you got?
I'm a squelch.
That's one of my favourite podcasts, which I listen to every week, which is called Pod Save America, and is a basically anti-kind of Trump podcast put together by guys who used to work in the Obama White House, had as a guest on this week Dan Rather, who, if you're not aware, is a kind of one of the greats, kind of like David Dimbleby of US TV reporting. He covered kind of he covered the civil rights marches. He covered Vietnam, and he's retired from kind of mainstream broadcasting. And he's in his kind of 70s or whatever. But he's he was talking about his new life as a Facebook blogger and basically kind of providing a really interesting kind of bridge for people who don't like Trump in America but are maybe of an older generation and are not willing to get their news from kind of, you know, blogs or Twitter or whatever. And but he's got he kind of writes things on Facebook which are kind of vitriolic but impeccably sourced and impeccably written, and delivers videos and kind of and stuff, and is just very, very it's just a really interesting kind of thing that you've got a guy in his kind of seventh decade who's embracing kind of relatively kind of new media forms and becoming a voice of trust and reason on a platform which maybe is not known for that.
Well, Facebook is the old people internet now.
Yes.
So he's the Walter Cronkite of the old people internet.
Yeah.
My closing sound chat, I was going to talk about how Disney are going to take all their properties onto their own Netflix next year, which means the end of Marvel Netflix, but who will miss it because Iron Fist and Defenders are so bad.
I'm liking the Punisher.
I haven't.
Has that started?
No. The trailer. Oh, right. The trailer. It looks good.
I think that starts this weekend, doesn't it? Maybe we can have a talk about it next week. But instead, I'm going to talk quickly about Kenny, a new documentary about the greatest man who ever lived, Kenny Dalglish. It's a Senna-style portrait of one man and his life, and it's absolutely astonishing. It's amazing. It's moving. It's powerful. It makes you feel all the joy of playing and experiencing football, even if you haven't ever played it, and the immense scale of the Hillsborough disaster, and you really do discover anew why he is such a hero. Even heathen supporters of other football teams, Matt Hall, will get a lot from this. Fantastic.
I remain to be convinced.
Even the heathen Sir Alex Ferguson comes out of it very well. And it's
why
just,
should he not?
It's just a really lovely, lovely film. And I would counsel anybody, even if you don't like football, to go, because you will discover why people do like football and why certain people can be bigger than football. You see a warmer and a funnier side to him than you think maybe exists. And it's just really persuasive. So, yes, even the heathen, Matt, are welcome to see it. And it's out on November the 20th.
Opening for one night in a very small screen somewhere in Gorton.
Yeah. Take a bus to a nicer place to see it. So there's your show. Thank you to Anna Wood and John Duran of The Quietest for coming in. Well, it's been a very successful pod clash. Thank you very much. You're welcome to come back.
Thanks for having us.
What's coming up next on The Quietest, then? What have you got?
What's coming up next in The Quietest?
We've got Steve Davis reviewing some Magma Live LPs for us.
All right. More than one Magma Live LP.
In the same area.
It's a Magma Treble Live LP.
We've got a review of hopefully all five of the King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard albums that have been released this year, or will have been released by the end of the year, coming up. And a whopping great review of the new Bjork album, which is
Oh, they've sent it to you. That's nice of them.
Yeah, well, you got it.
That's nice. Yeah, hello. So that's the quiet song. We urge you to have a look. So.
I would say if anyone is tuning into this from Remaniacs, they'd probably be interested in Mr. Grebel's review of the new Morrissey album as well.
Oh, right. Yes. I'm sure it's a very, very positive take.
Oh, yeah, it's very balanced.
Very, very balanced. So that's the end of this week's Big Mouth. Remember, beloved listener, you can hear this episode again and, of course, all of our past shows at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth. We'll be back again next week. Thanks to Matt, Anna and John, and we'll see you then. Bye bye. There we go, shout.